They're ignorant. They need to be educated. They need to go to a situation where they find out how it feels to be seen as something less than perfect and live as a person who isn't on top. For even a half an hour, I've watched white supremacists, as they call themselves, go through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise and come out crying and sobbing and say, I didn't know, why did I do it? And I say, now you know, fool.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Well, hello there, co-host Cornel West. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm always blessed to be in dialogue with you.
I know, it's my blessing entirely. It's like the best gift of 2020, and it was a year with few gifts, but this was the biggest one, so by far. So welcome everybody to the Tightrope. I'm thrilled that you've dared to join us here and that you're gonna get on the balance rope with us. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here, as I just mentioned, with Dr. Cornel West, fellow educator, friend. We have a fantastic guest today, don't we, Cornel?
Indeed. She's not only special, but she is a spiritual giant and a moral titan.
Spiritual giant and a moral titan. I love that. Jane Elliott, who's been an anti-Black racism activist, who's been working in small groups, large groups around the world in so many ways. But for the listening audience, to remind you, she's mostly known for this thing called the brown-eyed, blue-eyed. I believe she does not prefer the notion of calling it an experiment. Before we bring Jane on, I wanted to talk a little bit with you, Cornel, about this moment that we're facing right now. And it's a common moment when there's been serious attention paid to the issues. And that is this penchant for many whites who feel deeply concerned and often confused about what's going on, to ask people who they think are closer to the movement, maybe they're just Black, but they might also be activists or teachers. And the question is, what can we do, right? The question is, how can we get involved? What difference can we make? It's both a crucial question, but I often think is sort of the wrong question, because you have to ask, first of all, what do you know? do you know enough to know what to do? But it's an impulse that I think is important. And Jane, you know, sort of has answered that for herself. But I'm wondering, what would you say? Or has students or friends come up to you and asked you this question? What can I do? And what do you tell them?
Yeah, I tell them, beginning with what Malcolm X said at the very end of his life, he said, I am for truth, no matter who says it. I am for justice, no matter who's against it. I'm a human being first and foremost. So our response to my white brothers and sisters, or my Manila brothers and sisters, by saying you are a human being first and foremost. And the question is, what kind of human being you want to be? Do you want to be a human being for truth? Do you want to be a human being for justice? You're not doing Black people a favor in terms of being some kind of missionary-like ally. It has to do with what kind of person you are. If you committed to spiritual integrity, if you committed to moral courage, then you're going to fight every evil. And white supremacy is an evil. I would say there's other evils in the world, too, that we all ought to take a stand on. So that this whole sense of just acknowledging we're all on this human continuum together. Right. And there has always been human beings first who were white, who chose to be in opposition to white supremacy, going all the way back to Lydia Maria Child and Elijah Lovejoy, all the way up to Ann Braden and David Montgomery. It's a moral and spiritual choice in that way. And yes, there is a tremendous risk now. Oh, you got to be ready to be spit on and rebuked and misunderstood and misconstrued and undergo character assassination and maybe even literal assassination. That's what happens when white brothers and sisters associate themselves as human beings with Black people's freedom. There's no doubt about that.
It's so true. I often tell my students, look, there's a cost to not support dominant whiteness. There's a cost. It's not going to be free. You're going to realize what it means to not be privileged real quick.
Real quick.
They don't let you off the hook either. No, that's serious. You know, I like the move to the human, right? And to this core belief. I mean, this core motivation, right? That isn't about doing favors and so on. But I'm also wondering what to say. You're basically saying do it, but don't do it for me, right? Don't do it for other people. You got to do it because you know what's right and wrong. And you're here for truth.
Exactly. That's how you end up with long distance runners rather than sprinters.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. That's true. I'm feeling that. Well, we have someone who's been a long distance runner right here.
Yes, she has.
I think these first exercises were at least 50 years ago, and she's been going strong repeatedly. And I have many questions for her about this woman, how complicated it is. But let's bring her into the Zoom room and introduce her to us and our guests. There she is, Jane Elliott. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tightrope.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been on a tightrope for the last 52 years.
You have been. And so let's just jump right in with that. Help describe that tightrope for you and how you've experienced it.
Well, I made the mistake, according to my friends, associates, relatives, and peers, of saying it's all right not to be white. In fact, I don't believe I am white. If you look at my shirt, you can see that it's white, and you can see where my shirt stops and my skin begins. My skin isn't white. We need to, number one, get rid of the word white, because white was given to us during the Spanish Inquisition. And at that time, it was used black versus white. Black is evil. White is sacred and beautiful and harmonious. Well, I'm not a white person. I am a shade of brown, just like every other human being on the face of the earth is. And I'm tired of talking about race because there's only one. It's the human race, and we're all members of it. And if you are a Baha'i, you know that. And if you really read the Bible carefully, you know that too. So I jumped off the boat a number of years ago when I said to my students, would you like to know how it feels to be something other than white in this country? And that was the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. They all agreed that sounded like fun because they had no idea what was going to happen. So I judged my students that day on the basis of the color of their eyes. Now, I didn't learn this from, it didn't spring out of my mind all of a sudden. I learned it from Adolf Hitler. I was born the year Adolf Hitler came to power, and that was the same year that Franklin Roosevelt came to power. And so from 1933 until 1941, I heard about what a man was doing, and what he was doing at that time in Germany and throughout Europe is exactly what our so-called president is doing today. And if you want to learn about what's going on today, in the last 3.5 years, you need to read, go back, and don't go to a history book in a high school or a college. Go someplace and find out the truth about what happened in those days. And you'll find out that it looks exactly like what's happening right now. We're in a scary time. I separated my students according to the color of their eyes. I treated my brown-eyed people as we treat so-called white people in this country. I treated my blue-eyed people the way we treat people of other color groups. And immediately, when I told my students that blue-eyed people are as smart as brown-eyed people, they're as clean as brown-eyed people, they're as civilized as brown-eyed people, little brown-eyed Debbie sitting on the front row looked up at me and said, how come you're the teacher here if you got them blue eyes? And I thought, oh my God, this is it. This is how this feels. And for the rest of that day, those brown-eyed children treated me, what they did was tolerate me. And I found out that I don't want to be tolerated. I don't want to be tolerated. Strong people, powerful people, decide who to tolerate. People without power have to hope to be tolerated.
In that moment, when the students decided to tolerate you, just the instruction of hierarchy based on eye color undermined your whole authority as a teacher.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. They put up with me. Mm. It was so obvious. I pulled down the map that afternoon. And the map went around and around the road the way it does in that awful clacking sign. I said, well, I've done it again. And little brown-eyed Debbie once again said, well, what do you expect? You've got blue eyes, haven't you? And then blue-eyed Alan Moss in the back row stood up and said, if she didn't have them blue eyes, she'd be the principal or the superintendent. They're both brown-eyed. It was unbelievable. I watched children who couldn't read but were brown-eyed read as well as any of the children, as any other child in my class did, because I told them they were brilliant. I watched little brown-eyed dyslexic boys who couldn't spell words that they couldn't spell the day before. On the other hand, I had a tall, blonde, beautiful, blue-eyed, fair-skinned, really brilliant little girl came into my classroom in February reading at the sixth grade level. She had never multiplied. I taught her how to multiply the first 15 minutes of math class. She never made a mistake in multiplication again until the day she had the wrong color eyes. And I watched her disintegrate in front of my very eyes. I couldn't believe what I saw happening to that child. I learned more that day than I ever learned in a college psychology course. I learned about the danger, the absolute ugliness of what we're doing in this country when we even talk about separating people according to race. Because you and I and Cornel West are all members of the same race. There's only one.
But at the same time, you recognize that because this race as this construct has been institutionalized for so long that we have to call it the question. But in calling it the question, you have to recognize the devastating effects and consequences that it has created over 400 years.
Right. The fact that you were able to get the level of results you got so briefly means that's the recognition. 400 years of a system with that indoctrination is going to be embedded at levels that might be impossible to even imagine at this point.
Be very careful when we say you can't imagine it. What you're saying to pale faces, as the Native Americans called us, they call us pale faces because that's what we are, they think it's impossible to change it.
That's not a good point. You're right. I don't mean that.
It's impossible. Now, be very careful because I know that you can change it. I know that you can take a group of people, and I've done it for the last 52 years. I've been doing this. And from 1985 until about 2010, I was doing it with groups of adults in corporations all over the United States. I get the same results in groups of adults that I do with nine-year-old children. And they change too. They decide that they're going to stop thinking that way. They're going to stop behaving that way. And they're going to stop believing the lie. Because we can call this a social construct until hell freezes over. But what we're talking about is a lie. A lie that was deliberately contrived to make one group of people superior and everybody else not. Now, in view of the fact that only 25% of the people on the face of the earth are what we call white, we better get our act together. The other 75% are people of color who are just as smart as pale faces, just as clean as pale faces, just as creative as pale faces, and a whole lot more courageous than most pale faces are. They have to be courageous if they're going to live in this insanity in the United States of America.
Oh, that's true. But I mean, I think part of the challenge, my dear sister, is that we're talking about structures and systems and institutions. You can have individuals who can change their mind. You can have very decent individuals who decide to go to Wall Street and get incorporated into Wall Street greed, because the only way you operate within a certain institutional system is to be beholden to the values of that system. And so when you talk about individual prejudice, when you talk about personal attitudes, changing attitudes by means of empathy, you think of Black Like Me, you know, the classic by John Howard Griffin. You remember that 1961? It was a bestseller. And he's able to move back and forth based on empathy. So important. Affirmation of membership in the human race. So important. But you still got these structures in place. And if you don't change those structures, the individual prejudice is not going to be enough to transform them. You've got to have some movement. You've got to have contestation. You got to have power and pressure. You've been a part of those movements for so long. Tell us something about that. And how does the individual and structure relate to one another?
You can change structures by changing individuals. People say to me, well, this is a societal problem, not a personal problem. This is an individual problem. Societies are made up of individuals. If you can get enough individuals to recognize that they're acting in a it's not about being professional, it's about being humane. If you can get people to start realizing that there's only one race on the face of the earth and stop thinking that different faces are different races, you can change institutions. You can change the structure by getting enough people who have some real common sense. Somebody has said common sense in uncommon amounts is what the world calls wisdom. Well, if we could teach enough children, I have changed my children, my nine-year-old students, changed their parents' attitudes and changed their parents' vocabulary. The problem for the United States today right now is we are using 14th, 15th, 16th century vocabulary and ideas to try to solve problems in the 21st century. It doesn't work. You have to change what you're teaching in the schools. The answer to this whole problem is education. In schools in this country, we do not furnish education. We furnish indoctrination. Here are the ways you must be a good American citizen. Now, that alone, when we say American citizen, drives me right up the wall. Because America, we think, is only the 48 contiguous states, Alaska and Hawaii, and the islands. That isn't all of America. Every person in the lake who lives in the country, from the northern most part of Alaska, of Canada, I'm sorry, to the southernmost point of South America, is an American. And we're going to build a wall across the southern border of America to keep anybody out who isn't American. Well, all those folks in Central and South America are Americans. Let's stop using 15th and 16th century vocabulary to solve 21st century problems. Now, we've got lots and lots of people out there who can use huge, long, 5, 7, 14 syllable words, but they can't remember to say United States of America because we are so arrogant that we think that we are the only Americans. I didn't realize that we were wrong about that till my father had friends come back after the Second World War. And those soldiers who had been through hell in the Second World War said, we found out while we were overseas that we aren't the only Americans. We had people there from lots of countries in South America. And they said, we're fighting this battle too, and we're also Americans. You see, our vocabulary, our language is larded with racist statements.
But one of the challenges here is that even the term American in the hemispheric sense is still a construct. We're still part of a human race. And even by using the term American in the hemispheric sense, very much like black and white, is still a construct that will divide. So it raises the issue, how do we talk about particular groups of any sort,
right,
given the fact that we're part of the same species? And race is nation is another, America's another, Finland is another, Nigerian is another. That's going to be a challenge.
Also religions, spiritual organizations. I mean, people have multiple identities.
Right. People have different levels of identities, my dear sister. I mean, I think that's part of the challenge. But how would you respond to that about even your talk about American is as much a construct that gets in the way of our acknowledging we're part of one human race as just black and white?
So we can call ourselves citizens of the United States of America. But is that too many syllables for somebody to say instead of America, United States of America? That is the truth. You want to talk about the truth? Let's talk about the truth. Yes, we are members of lots of different groups, but we are not members of different races. We've got to stop talking about races as if there were lots of them. There's
okay,
only
let me,
one.
Let me ask you a question about this. I mean, there's no question it's a biological falsehood. It's a 16th century idea. I mean, I'm with you on all of that. But I guess let me just speak personally as a person who has spent, you know, most of my career trying to understand the particular beauty of what I would call African-American music and culture. Okay. And for me, it seems to be an important mechanism for maintenance, sustenance, protection, self-care, collective survival, transformation of the world. I guess if I'm just speaking personally, while I'm completely in agreement, we're all in one human race, certainly wouldn't be challenging that. I worry about this idea of when we say we want to get rid of race altogether, what does that do with the cultural dimensions that vulnerable non-white populations have used to protect and save and transform themselves against odds that you know as well as everyone else on listening likely were just untenable, right? They were just insurmountable seemingly. And yet with that cultural infrastructure, with that resistive tradition, we were able to make tremendous strides really that really weren't logical to make. So you're saying, give it up. Race doesn't exist. What should we call this tradition? Or are you saying we should get rid of it?
I'm saying that number one, it's perfectly logical to use the word African-American. African-Americans come in lots and lots of different colors, shapes, sizes, genders, and gender orientations. They come in lots of different religions, and they have lots of different preferences where music and everything else is concerned. Every person is an individual. If you want to persist in what you believe in, that's fine. Live your life. But don't live and don't let me live my life as though we are members of a different race. You and I are 30th to 50th cousins, period. because we both have the same ancestor back there, 300,000 to 500,000
years ago. You and I might be closer than that, given my own background.
I know. Yes, we could very well be. We could very well be. I know that if I trace my DNA back far enough, I am going to find a portion of my DNA comes from a country in Africa. Make no mistake about that, because we all did. But we have taught the wrong thing long enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, people have definitely done that.
But you don't have the right to say, well, it's a racial difference. It's not a racial difference. It's a cultural difference. It's an educational difference.
Okay, all right. I see
it's
that.
It's a traditional difference.
I wanted to clarify that for our listeners in particular, because I think sometimes those things do get collapsed, culture and race. And for people of African-American descent, they may want to hold on to both of those things as a self-protection. But I hear your distinction, which is important.
I want to come back to your point, though, Sister Tricia, regarding Sister Jane, because let's just think of Brother George Perry Floyd Jr.'s funeral. We all saw the funeral, right?
Yes.
Now, that was profoundly human, with overflowing with love, not a moment of hate. But there's never been that kind of funeral in terms of its style, in terms of its singing, in terms of its gestures on the vanilla side of town. That was a funeral rooted in Black culture. The way they sang, the way they walked in, went and got their coffin, the way the preacher preached, Brother Sharpton, so that those cultural traditions that have come up as a result of this construct of race that, and Sister Jane is hitting the nail on the head here in terms of it just being a lie. It is nothing but a lie, right? Definitely. But lies get institutionalized and people respond, and in the middle of their human attempt to come to terms with profound grief, they have to be able to fall back on something. And what they fall back on is culture. What they fall back on are this style, the ways in which they can muster enough courage to just keep living in a certain sense. So in that sense, you say, well, was the funeral a Black funeral? Yes, in many ways it was.
But Jane is saying, Cornell, it's an African-American cultural funeral, right? And that she doesn't want people to collapse race with cultural specificity.
Yeah, I agree with it there.
And I think that by using Black, which has its own radical history, right, as a way to basically try to counter the use of Black as a lower status in the world, but to claim it as a collective identity, has this pitfall because you don't get the cultural specificity that prevents us from collapsing ourselves into a race category.
But you see, we don't really study Black history. In this country, we have decided we're going to have Black History Month. So we have 20 days in which you might talk about Black history in the school. The other 8 months of the year, you teach the lie. And also, when we teach about Black history in the schools, generally, it starts with slavery. If you haven't read Anthony Browder's work, Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization, have you read it?
If you haven't read it,
God's sake, get it and read it. 4,000 years before the birth of Jesus Christ. If you haven't seen this, I know you know all these things, but I'm not sure the people that are watching this do. Have you seen this National Geographic?
No, I haven't seen that issue. I haven't seen that issue, my sister. No.
Oh, my God, get this issue. These are twin girls. These are twin girls. And in this issue, you will see a map that shows where modern human beings started and where they went from there. Black people without any modern technology were able to travel from the area of the equator and to populate every landmass on the face of the earth. Now you tell me how those people that we have decided over the years were less than, how they managed to do that if they were as ignorant as we accuse Black people of being. This is the worst education you could possibly imagine what we have done in this country for the last 300 years. We need to get over it. We need to realize that we don't really appreciate the intelligence in Black people. We deny it, and we try not to let it be seen. We try to deny it. We try to cover it up. We do social constructs, and we use we use 5- and 6-syllable words.
Well, Sister Jane, but when you listen to the "we," when you say "we,"
I'm
not really talking about me,
we,
because I've never assumed Black people.
I said "we."
The "we," but even the "we" that you use happens to be reinscribed back into the Black and white, because the history of the "we," the white supremacy is so vicious
that even when we're trying to eliminate the category,
right,
we still have to use a we, because Black people have had such a long history of reaching the same conclusion you have in terms of our humanity.
Right.
65% of white brothers and sisters voted for who? Trump. 52% of white sisters voted for who? Trump. Which means that we has got a hell of a lot of problems. 98% of Black folk are voting against Trump, which means they're reaching very different conclusions, even though the categories of white and Black are constructs, but they have this historical resonance given the viciousness of white supremacy being historically enacted. And that's why the issues that you're raising are crucial, fundamental, and has a spiritual and moral content to it. But it's a challenge because we have to move very close, very cautiously, because we're in a paradox.
Who has to move very cautiously? I don't have to move very cautiously. Wait a minute.
I was just telling you have to move cautiously because when you talk about we, you're not talking about me.
Absolutely. When I talk about we, I'm talking about what we pale faces have done.
Right,
we pale faces have been running the show, and we're running it badly, and we're running it right down the tubes. I'm not talking about we, the collective, because we, the collective, didn't have the power, wouldn't have the power to change this situation unless a bunch of those of us who are so-called white people join the group and say, no, we've had enough. Well, this whole thing is totally unnecessary, could have been stopped at the beginning, but it But racism, hey, racism is a money-making project.
And it's got capitalist origins. It's got Black collaborators with the white supremacists.
We need to stop using the phrase white supremacists, because white people are not supreme. They are pale faces who have learned to play the game in a way that will keep them on top and other people on the bottom. And we do it at our own peril. Within 30 years, pale faces are going to be a numerical minority in the United States of America. And that's the reason you're seeing real anger in the pale-faced societies right now, because they're scared to death of what's going to happen to them when they don't have numerical majority in this country. You need to take a look at what we've done in the past and realize
that. But what do you call people who hate Black people? What is the word you use? When I say white supremacists, I mean human beings who hate Black people or indigenous people and so forth. Now, I'm saying white supremacists. You say don't use white supremacists. What word do you use for people who hate Black people?
I call them ignorant.
Well, they're more than ignorant. They're more than ignorant, though. Some of them are very smart. They just want their money and they want their power. Now, you know that.
I didn't say they were stupid. You can't fix stupid. They're ignorant. They need to be educated. They need to go to a situation where they find out how it feels to be seen as something less than perfect and live as a person who isn't on top. For even a half an hour, I've watched white supremacists, as they call themselves, go through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise and come out crying and sobbing and say, I didn't know, why did I do it? And I say, now you know, fool. You didn't know
do
before,
you think,
but now you know,
ask
you know what the problem
here
is, and you need to fix it.
Right. Let me ask a question here. I'm interested in the long-term impact, because what you're describing from these exercises is pretty remarkable. I mean, from all levels, the way the students operated, internalizing it. I had no idea that the equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan came out crying. That's definitely a movie worth making.
It could be crocodile tears.
Wait a minute.
Let me just ask my question. Was this change documented over time? Were you able to turn to these people and have a conversation? Because I'm eager to hear, what did they do as they adjusted, or did they retreat back? What happened?
That's the question.
You want me to answer the question?
Yeah, sure. That's why I asked it.
You need to realize that the kids in the film, The Eye of the Storm, have you seen the film, The Eye of the Storm, made in my classroom? All right. All those kids came to me. The principal handed my classroom that year and said, these kids are duds, duds, duds. Pass them out of here. They'll never amount to anything anyway. And he said, they're never going to graduate from high school. And I was thinking some really unpleasant words about that fool in my head. And so I went to the office. I looked at their cumulative files. All of them had high math scores, low reading and spelling scores. Those kids are all dyslexic. They had been taught by their previous teachers that they couldn't learn. Now, it wasn't that they couldn't learn. It was their teachers couldn't teach to their special needs. So I know how to teach the dyslexic child. Those children went from the first grade level to the fourth grade level in 9 months' time. And some of them ended up reading. Their individual reading scores were in sixth grade. Now, that didn't happen suddenly. They didn't suddenly overnight mature. I knew how to teach them, and I knew how to teach them the right way. I knew how to educate them. Those kids, one of those kids who was supposed to have been called mentally retarded, he became a lawyer. Now, I didn't succeed with all of them. He's just a damn lawyer. But I did the best I could. One of them became a junior and senior high school principal and has been in education as an administrator for all the years since then, since he went to college. And now he has left administration and gone made a business of his own. At least 6 and maybe 8 of those poor little unable to learn children went on to 2 or 4 or more years of post-high school education. They would not have done that had I not said to them, look, you're brilliant and I can prove it to you. You're going to learn to read, you're going to gain 3 years of reading ability in a single year just because you're so brilliant. If we would stop telling white supremacists that they aren't supreme, the first thing they do is collapse. They go through the 5 stages of grief. First, they argue with you. First, they deny it. Then they get angry. Then they get belligerent. Then they begin to bargain. Then they, all right, they become despair. They become depressed. And then they accept it and they go on. And they change the way they behave from then on. I've had people call me several years after having been through the exercise in US West at US West Direct and Public Service of Colorado and say, I've never gone backwards since I was in your class. Nobody is ever allowed to use those words about me anymore. I will no longer tolerate it. I'm telling you, we could change the face of this country into something other than what we are today. You are not born a racist. You aren't born a bigot. You have to be carefully taught. So if we changed education, we could change this whole thing around. I am not prepared to say it's going to be like this forever. It hasn't been like this forever, and it doesn't have to be like this forever.
We're agreeing, Sister Jen. All we're saying to you is that the evil that you're talking about is not rooted only in ignorance. It's rooted in interest. It's rooted in power. It's rooted in structures of domination. So that when Sister Tricia asks you, well, what are the forms of behavior that these people engage in after they cry? Do they become part of the Black Freedom Movement? Do they become a part of a freedom movement the way you have devoted your life? Are they willing to undergo the things you had to undergo in Iowa with the treatment of yourself and your children and so forth and so on? That's more than ignorance and knowledge. There was something inside of your heart and spirit that led you to keep fighting in the face of those interests. You recognize what you went through in Iowa was not just ignorance. When you were cast as an in lover, that's not just ignorance. That's a deep.
That contempt. Is ignorance.
And no, it's a that contempt is, and a hatred because you were challenging their whole system.
But it's a learned response. It's a learned response, and anything you learn, you can unlearn. We can unlearn those responses. We can learn responses that are positive and that are accepting and that are appreciative and valuing other human beings. We can do that. I know we can. If we can't, then we might as well just hang it up.
I believe we can. But what are the responses the response to? They're partly the response to wanting to hold on to power and money and status. That's not just ignorance.
It's ignorance if you think that your ability to hold on to those things is dependent on the color of your skin. You know people who are other than the pale face variety who are absolutely brilliant. Nat King Cole had to go through the back door in order to go into the lounge where he was going to be singing.
That's
he
right.
couldn't buy a home where he wanted to. Now, this isn't That's about right. white privilege. This is about white ignorance. White people are running the show. Pale-faced people are running the show, and they are determined to perpetuate the ignorance that keeps them in power.
But you can't run the show based just on ignorance and knowledge. You run the show because you have power. You run the show because you have enough power to perpetuate what you want.
Here's one of the ways you get that power. You show the picture of a black man on the ground with a man in a blue policeman's uniform with his knee on his neck, and you show that over and over and over and over on every network, and you say, oh my, isn't that too bad? But you are intimidating little black boys, and you are frightening the black mothers because they know that what that means is this can happen to your son if he gets out of line. And he doesn't have to get very far out of line. He can be walking across a playground with a stick in his hand, and some white cop can shoot him because he thinks it's a gun. Now, if you show that often enough, then that teaches little black boys to be scared and their mothers to be terrified. And they have dreams that they have nightmares at night. And the boogeyman in the nightmare is somebody who looks like me. Now, every time I see that, and you can talk now, and it's all over television, America in crisis. America isn't in crisis. The United States of America is having now to come up with the penalty for what we have done to people for the last 300 years in this country.
That's right.
You know, we've sown the wind, and we are now reaping the whirlwind.
That's true.
Every time I do a speech, some liberal white female stands up and says, well, if they get power, aren't they going to want to treat us the way we treated them? And I say, well, let's see if they are. And I did this with the University of Houston, and Angela Davis was sitting on the stage with me. I said, okay, let's find out if you're right. Well, every person, every female or male in this room who considers themselves black, who wants to get even with all white folks, please stand. Half of that 1,500-person audience was black. Three young black males stood up, and the rest of them looked at him like, are you crazy? And these white folks look, oh, they look so much better with that. I said, isn't that great? See, they don't want to get even with all of us, but let's be honest about this. Well, every black person in this room who wants to get even with one or two white people, please stand. All those kids jumped up laughing and cheering and high-fiving one another and just tickled to death. And then now this woman looks scared again. I said, see, there it is. They don't want to get rid of all, but get even with all of us. Each one of them wants to get even with one or two. Now, if you want to survive in the future, you behave in such a way that you aren't one of the one or two they want to get even with. Now, I think that woman learned something that day, and I think those black students learned something that day, and I think every pale-faced person in that audience learned something that day. And afterward, I was out in the hall with the rest of them, having coffee, and Angela Davis said to me, Jane, you and I could go on the road together. I said, give me a call and tell me when. I could turn the world around.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Let me ask you a question that relates to some of the things you said, in particular, referring to this George Floyd moment. I mean, I'm really interested in your point of view there about the repetition of violence, even as it's trying to incite change, it also reinforces people's perceptions. That said, this does seem, people claim this moment is somehow different. And they're saying in particular, many whites, or I love this pale-faced people, I might have to pick this one up. You know, that these pale-faced people are changing their minds. Their previous stance was they didn't really think it was a big problem. And now all of a sudden there's an outpouring of significant effort and serious critique and protest. What do you think about this? I didn't see it before. And do you trust that this moment might really be different? Do you think either one of those things are true? Can you share what you've been thinking about that?
You've got to stop believing what you believed before in the rightness of whiteness. You've got to realize that there's only one race. You've got to realize that what you want to call yourself is fine as long as you don't say it's a race. As long as you stop talking about racial differences, as long as you stop, you want to talk about color differences, go ahead. You want to talk about religious differences, go ahead. There are lots of differences, but they are not differences that make us better or worse. They are differences that make us different.
So do you trust what these people are saying? Do you trust that these whites are now, these pale-faced people are now?
I am so inspired that people of all colors are out there demonstrating and protesting in protest of what is happening to black people. What happened to black people this month, black person this month? But those things have been happening to black people for the last 300 years. And we have elected a fool who says, first comes the looting and then comes the shooting. He's got that wrong. First we came to this country and first we shot them and then we took over their land after we had killed as many as we can. It's what we have been doing. It is called building an empire. That's what we white folks do because we are ignorant. Make no mistake about this. We know that if we can perpetuate the ignorance in the white population of this country, that we can perpetuate this idiocy. As long as people like those on the business roundtable make the decisions in this country, that's how long we'll hold on to the idiocy of race, of racism. Racism is the result of poor education, but education that people who have power want to continue, want to perpetuate indefinitely. What we have in this country does not teach people to love one another. It teaches them to love people who look like them. And white people with my color skin are more valuable and more lovable. This is nonsense.
Well, we all believe in the golden rule and we want to institutionalize
No, I don't. No, I don't. I do not.
You don't believe in the golden rule?
I do. Heavens, well, do I don't think you do. Wait a minute. The golden rule says in my Bible, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Wait a minute. If you and I get on an airplane and I have a piece of luggage to put in the overhead rack, and you say to me, can I put that up for you, ma'am? I'm going to say, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. However, if we get on an airplane and you have a piece of luggage to put in the overhead rack, and I say, can I do that for you, Sonny? You're going to say, I think I can handle it myself. I happen to know that not everyone wants to be treated the way I want to be treated. Younger people don't want to be treated the way I want to be treated. People of other colors groups don't want to be treated the way I want to be treated. People of different religious groups don't want to be treated the way I want to be treated. I believe in the platinum rule, which says, do unto others as others would have you do unto them. In other words, you have to ask them what they want. You have to listen to their answers. And listening is the hardest thing that we do. Listen to their answers. And then if what they ask you to do is illegal, indecent, or immoral, you have to do it. But the first thing you have to do is listen to what they say. I don't treat others the way I want to be treated. I try to treat others the way they want to be treated. Because that way we can...
Well, you can actually have both. Because I think the Christian conception of the golden rule is that no one would choose to be hated, dominated, subjugated, exploited, and violated. Now, if people want to be dominated and violated, that's a different thing. But the assumption is they don't, because they have a dignity made in the image of God. So that the golden rule, broadly understood, can embrace what you're talking about. But I think, again, where I'm challenging you in good spirit is when you talked about empire, you got to talk about military aspect. You got to talk about land, gold, resources that people want access to. So it's not going to be just the ignorance of founding an empire. When they came to the New World to engage in the land of indigenous peoples, it wasn't just the ignorance. It was the ignorance that you talk about, but it was a whole lot more too, my dear sister. It was they wanted their land. They wanted their gold in that land. They wanted resources in that land. That's called interest. And interests are not the same thing as ignorance. Both become the pillar of these lies, like white supremacy or male supremacy or any other lie. The lies about Jewish folk, the lies about Arabs, the lies about Muslims, the lies about Mexicans. But as long as you talk only about ignorance and education, it only takes you so far. You've got to talk about power and interest as well. That's where I'm challenging you. But tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, I think we're proving that you're wrong, because right now there are a whole lot of people who were ignorant about what was really going on. And now they are seeing the light, and they are seeing how this really works, and they are saying, we're not going to put up with this. They are saying maybe police departments shouldn't have that kind of power. They're saying maybe there's something wrong with the system. There is something wrong with the system. And what's wrong with the system is we don't know history. We don't study history. You know, I suspect that in most social studies books at any level, the Holocaust maybe covers two or three paragraphs. When I watch what is happening in the streets of the United States since Mr. Trump's election, I have watched things happen that I watched happen when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. We are now replicating what happened in Germany. The first thing that scared me was what I saw happening was what I did in my third grade classroom with the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise. This man is doing exactly that. He's replicating what Hitler did. And I learned the exercise from Hitler. I separated my students according to color eyes because I had that's what he did. That's one of the ways he decided went into the gas chamber. Now, I see happening in this country today exactly what happened in my third grade classroom. You pick out a group of people on the basis of a physical characteristic over which they have absolutely no control. You assign negative traits to them because of that physical characteristic. You lower your expectations for them. You force them to live down to your expectations of them. And when they do, you can say, see, you're all like that. And it's because of that physical characteristic. Now, we know how to do that. I know. I'm talking about we, the people who run this show. We know how to do that. And we have learned it from masters. We're doing it today. We should have known better after history. And I thought we did know better when we finished the Second World War. I thought things are going to be better. And then we had to go someplace else to help them start a war. And then someplace else. And then someplace else. It's all about power. It's all about oil. It's all about natural resources. It's all about keeping the we in power. I know that. But I also know.
That's all I'm saying. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about power
now. If you do a good enough job of educating people, you will educate them to realize that once you get on top, then all you have to do for the rest of the time is see to it that nobody knocks you down.
Right. So let me.
No, I think we're reaching an agreement here. The ignorance and the interest.
Well, we were in agreement when you called. We were in agreement when you asked me to be on this thing. But now you want me to go along to get along. No, I will not. I know that individuals can make a difference. I think one person can make a difference. If you don't think one person can make a difference, look at what has happened in this country in the last 3.5 years. One person can make a negative difference, and one person doing the right thing instead of the wrong thing can make a positive difference. And every one of those people who are marching in the streets all over the United States of America are determined to make a positive difference. Each one of them is just one. And they've chased out the ones who would come in and create a riot. And they know who they are now. And when they see them doing it, these people are saying, don't do that. Don't be doing that. And so this has become protest and not riot. One person can make a difference. You have made a difference and you know it. This person who is our boy grown tall in the president's residence has made a tremendous difference in this country by playing off the people who want to stay wealthy and to hell with the rest of us.
So one of the questions that I thought would be really interesting, do you think, Jane, that the brown-eyed, blue-eyed exercise can become or should become an ongoing part of police training?
Number one, I don't believe in police training. We train dogs and horses and members of the military to react to certain stimuli in certain prescribed ways. I don't believe in training. I believe in education. I'm an educator. The word educator comes from the root duck deuce, which means lead, the prefix E, which means out, the suffix A-T-E, which means the act of, and the suffix O-R, which means one who does. I think we need to re-educate the police ones. But first, you have to re-educate their educators. Every person, practically speaking, in the United States of America believes what they learned in school and in church. And you go to church in some churches and there's a picture of Jesus Christ and he has fairly light skin and light hair and we don't know what color his eyes are. But it says in the Bible he had kinky, woolly black hair and feet of bronze. We believe what we have learned. We have learned the wrong thing. We have to re-educate policemen instead of just retraining them. You can't just train them to behave in different ways toward these people. You have to educate them to realize that the color of a person's skin does not determine their worth as a human being. That's what we have to do. We have to re-educate them. And I think that, yes, that would make a difference. I did the exercise in Australia. There were 3 members of the police department in the exercise. One was a woman, a pale-faced woman. When I saw her coming up the walk, I thought, I'm going to get you. You are going to be blue-eyed if it's the last thing I ever do. Because she walked with that superior strut. The other two were tall, pale-faced males. And when it was over, those tall, pale-faced males said, I never went through something like this before in my life. I'll never treat people that I have to deal with it the way I have treated them in the past. I'll remember what we went through here. And the woman was crying and she said, I had no idea. I had no idea that this is how it felt. I said, well, do you know now? She said, absolutely. You know, this is going to change the way I behave.
Yeah, I totally hear you, what you're saying there. I guess, you know, maybe this will just give you something to battle with, but I don't know if I believe people who say that. I mean, how blind can you actually be? Now, I've studied whiteness and I've studied race in America for a long time. But I feel like what they're basically saying is, they say out loud, and you're the expert on this exercise, but here's my suspicion, that they say out loud, I just never knew, it's terrible, you know, I didn't have any. What they mean is, I don't like when this is happening to me. And so they're languaging it as empathy, because that's what you're asking them to do. But I don't really necessarily trust it. That's why I was asking, how do they respond months later? What are their responses? Do you think I'm being too suspicious, Jane, or untrusting in a way that's not helpful? What do you think?
I work for the Iowa Department of Corrections in Iowa City, at a workshop in Iowa City. And I put all those folks through the blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise. You'd ought to take a look at the film, and you really ought to take a look at the film, A Class Divided, because you see those folks in that situation, and you see one young white male standing in the back. He can't get anything right. He has the wrong color eyes, and he can't think straight, and he doesn't have any pencil neither. And it was really agonizing for him. At the end of the exercise, when you do the debriefing, he was sitting in the front row against the wall, and he said he never felt that bad before in his life. He had no idea what it felt like to be in that situation. I think you have to teach people to empathize with those who are different from themselves. He called his daughter, maybe called me several years later and asked me if I would talk to her class. And I said, sure, what's the problem? And she said, well, my dad was Brother Roger, when you did that exercise in Iowa City, I said, oh my God, he's your dad. She said, yeah. I said, well, how did that affect me? She said, he was a different man when he came home after that. And then I said, well, could you get him to talk? And she said, he's right here. So he got on the phone. He was in the classroom because they were discussing the movie that they made in my classroom with him in it. And I said, what are you doing today, Brother Roger? And he said, I changed jobs right after I went through that exercise. I couldn't go through any more of that. I couldn't, as a human being, agree to go along with what we were doing in the Iowa Department of Corrections. Don't tell me you can't change people. I can't change people. People can change themselves when they see what is wrong and realize what is wrong. And if we would teach empathy in the schools, and Kenneth Clark, the person who did the black and brown doll studies, said if teachers would do what Jane Elliott did, we could change what happens in this society. If you don't think treating people positively or negatively on the basis of a physical characteristic or which you have no control, then you tell me why we have racism in this country. It's because you can change them. You can make people feel less than by putting them in menial jobs, paying them less than they're worth, forcing them to live in substandard housing. And then when the middle class people want to get closer to downtown, you can wipe out that neighborhood and call it regentrification, when in fact it isn't regentrification, it's racism at work.
Call it what you want. But this is my point, though, Sister Jane. It's not just racism. It's profits. When they exploited Africans in the South, it wasn't just racism. They were exploiting their labor to make huge amounts of profits for a ruling class called slaveholders. So you can't just talk about ignorance and racism. We're still doing it, and we know better. Economic reality. This is what I'm pushing.
We're still doing it, and we know better.
That's true.
And if we believe, if we practice the golden rule, which we don't, then you can preach until the cows come home, and you're still preaching something that is telling some people to submit and other people to be bigger than, better than, and wealthier than.
Right. I'm going to have to interrupt because we're out of time, but this was a really terrific conversation, very spirited. No, and, you know, we're getting at the nuances of how white, well, maybe not supremacy, we've already disabused that, you know, how white privilege actually works. It's a very nuanced process. And sometimes we can see it and sometimes we don't. Yeah, I know that book, Jane. That's a very solid book. On
Have you read it?
Uh-huh. I've read it. I've taught it.
Good for you.
Yeah.
When you know that this is what this segregation in this country, for the most part, is de jure and not de facto. And the people who put that together are people who don't know the truth. And the truth is that you can't judge people by the color of their skin. But they have learned over the years that it's all right. It works. If it works, keep on doing it.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. It does work for them. And we're going to try to disabuse them of this notion. We got to keep you on the road doing this exercise, given the results you're getting. We have to get you a bus, like those nuns on a bus, and get you going. Anyway, thank you, Jane. This was a wonderful conversation.
You've been along this as well in a beautiful way. Absolutely.
Thank you.
We'll see you again. Thank you for having me. Bye now.
That was a spirited conversation, Cornell.
Well, she's such a force for good in so many ways. She's been at it a long time. I like her tenacity, you know, going back and forth, back and forth. But I always just have a deep suspicion of this focus on individual prejudice. She's absolutely right. Individuals make big differences in the world, but they have to be parts of collectivities, of movements, of counter institutions, counter structures against the powers that be. That's what we kept coming back to. But just this issue of class and capitalism is still something that too many people are reluctant to really want to hit head on. That's why I appreciated her tenacity holding on to her position and really embracing much of what we were talking about, but still using a language that tended to resist and hold on to ignorance as opposed to the deep economic, deep psychic, deep social interests of groups when it comes to racism.
Right. And honestly, people who are successful at giving up a certain kind of assumption of hatred and assumption of hierarchy can still go ahead, support the banks that give them a better interest rate than they're going to give you, than they're going to give me. They're going to pass on those transformational assets to the next generation, which allows their kids to go buy the house that your kids or my kids might not be able to buy. And you know, so on and so forth. So the structure reinforces the ideology, and the ideology reinforces the structure. You can't break it only on one level. You know, what I would have asked, what is the critique of colorblindness? Because some of what I understood her to be saying felt like colorblind ideology, right? I don't see color, race doesn't exist. But then the structures can stay in place, and I can be just a really terrific, friendly, multicultural human.
No, I think it's true. But I was
but it's powerful, and you know,
to come on and wrestle with us in that way. She's got a wonderful intellectual and spiritual sense of engagement.
Yeah, and I like the way she holds people accountable. I mean, she helps pale-faced people get themselves together.
That's true.
Definitely helping that. But it's so good to be with you today, Cornell.
No, same here.
Thank
indeed,
you so
indeed.
Much.
Well, salute you like always, my dear sister, Tricia Professor Rose herself.
Thank you, dear. Same thing, you know, back at you. And everybody else, thank you so much for joining us. Sometimes it's going to be a tightrope. Sometimes it won't. You never know. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Tightrope Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know. Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to 411@speakerbox.com. That's the numbers 411@speakerbox.com. The Tightrope Podcast is produced by Speakerbox Media in collaboration with the Podcast Laundry Production Company and is executive produced by Dr. Cornell West, Professor Tricia Rose, and Jeremy Berry.